Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming this morning. And I want to welcome all those Florida Community Mindfulness members who are live streaming today. How many people, Teresa? 20. There are 28 people, members, who are live streaming. And this talk is being recorded and will be posted on the Florida Community Mindfulness's YouTube channel at some point in the future. So important that I say that. So this is my first Dharma talk to you in the new year. The last time I was in the hall was on New Year's Day when we had a beginning a new ceremony. Unfortunately, it was only for members, and that's not because we're some kind of elite group, but because we had probably over 100 members here. So you can see that was filled up the hall. But what we do at our beginning a new ceremony is use the new year to both take stock of our past year, our actions of body, speech, and mind in the past year, and our intentions and whether we live them. Then most importantly, of course, is to begin anew and to really think about, contemplate, reflect on what are my aspirations for the coming year. And perhaps many of you who weren't there did the same on the new year. So why don't we just take a moment, just close your eyes a second. And if you did around the new year sort of make aspirations, intentions for the new year, why don't you check in with how you're doing? Today is January 12th. Thank you. So we're not quite 2 weeks into the new year. How are we doing? Have we even remembered our intentions? If we have remembered them, how often have we remembered them? And even if we've remembered them, have we actualized it? Have we really understanding the power of intention and commitment? Have we consistently, in these last 12 days, been cultivating whatever it is we wanted to cultivate anew? So just check in with yourself. How are you doing? And if this was a school, you might be graded. So why don't you just give yourself a grade? Would you give yourself an A, B, C, a D, or a wonderful F? How would you rate your follow through? And again, this is no time for recrimination or guilt or shame. It's just a time just to objectively assess. And we don't have to tell anybody else, so this is private. You can be very objective with yourself, hopefully. So this is very important. Whether we are new or old practitioners, whether we are Buddhist or non-Buddhist, or something else in terms of our religious spiritual path, it doesn't really matter. But one thing I've learned over the years is this is really the key piece. Oftentimes, learning the practices, knowing the validity or the efficaciousness of the practices, you know, can become fairly obvious to us early on. But yet the practice of them, the consistent integration of them into our life, this seems to be the problem. And it's often, I think, that's why I'm taking the time again this morning to talk with you, because I think if we're not attentive to this failure to really have clear aspirations for our life, to actualize them in clear commitments in our life, how we want to be, how we want to show up, and without a consistent kind of self-awareness on a weekly, daily, hourly, minute by minute self-awareness, it is very difficult to affect substantial change. And many of us would like to see some substantial change in our life. And we're often frustrated because it doesn't occur. And oftentimes we look to all kinds of reasons rather than, I think, often this obvious reason, which is it is often a failure of clarity of aspiration, clarity of commitment, clarity of belief in the possibility of it, and a willingness to be somewhat diligent in its implementation. Because my experience is when all these things are present, we succeed. And most of us here know that already because we've applied that in our life to accomplish worldly tasks, careers, education, raising a family, learning a craft, a skill, exercise. You know, many of us understand this exact truth and probably have seen ourselves succeed in perhaps a chosen area. But often, I think, when it comes to this most essential, in my opinion, it may not be your opinion, the most essential thing about our life, which is, how am I as a person? What is it like to be me? Am I a happy person? Am I a peaceful person? Am I a loving person? Am I a kind person? Am I a considerate person, a patient person, a generous person? Right? All not, you know, the attributes of what it's like to be me. Oftentimes we don't have that same clarity of aspiration and that same energetic application that we have brought to other areas of our life where we have wanted some degree of success or competency. Is that, does that make sense? Take a moment just to reflect on that. I mean, don't take my words for it. Is that true? Have we historically able to put much more energy commitment into achieving worldly goals and sort of downplay the energy we put into our own healing, transformation, being the kind of person that I want to be? Not just the kind of person that people see from the outside, because that may not really be what we see on the inside. But really being that person we want to be. Take a moment just to reflect your own experience, your own truth. So in the month of January, usually in our community, we have a fairly active program of Dharma programs, retreats, and intensive practice periods, workshops, classes. And usually in January, we sort of take a little intermission, a little intercession. But recently, people might have received an email about transmission ceremony that's coming up in, I think, the first week or first weekend in February. Also, people have received information about ordination in the Order of Interbeing and the aspirancy program there. And I just want to use kind of this time to talk about what in Buddhism we call refuge. And in the transmission ceremony, what people do is they formally take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, Sangha, and receive the five mindfulness trainings. But I want to talk about refuge in sort of a bigger context than just the Buddhist context, and also in terms of what I was just talking about. So, refuge. A refuge is what? It's a safe place. We go to refuge because it gives us a sense of safety, security. We feel protected, right? And it's usually perceived as a geographical place. It is a place where typically a person would remove themselves from the storms, physical, emotional, interpersonal, and come to a place of safety. Place of refuge. Now, before I talk about refuge in Buddhism, I want to suggest that all of us are already and have already taken refuge. Okay? The question is, where do we go for refuge? Where have we historically and where do we currently go to refuge to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel balanced, to feel, you know, to be nourished? And where do we go for refuge? To restore ourselves. We all do it. We go, where do we go? What? We go home. You mean physical home? We go home, so we have a physical home. Oh, I close the door, I'm safe. All right, so we have geographical places. Right. Some of us may go to, where are the geographical places might we go for restoration and safety? What? We may go to nature. Right? Go to a park, go to the beach. We feel good, we feel restored. We de-stress, don't we? Where else do we take refuge in this life? Books, reading, knowledge, right? How about relationships? Do we run to relationships? Not just in big things, but even, you know, we're upset, we call somebody, don't we? Or in these days, we go online and we vent, right? Is that true? But I mean, we go to relationships. We go to what? What kind of other activities do we go to restore ourselves, de-stress, feel safe? We come here. We meditation. What? The refrigerator, food, thank you. Yeah. Before we get into the good stuff, let's be honest. Yeah, we go to food, don't we? We go to drugs, sex, rock and roll, right? You know, where do people go in our society? See, we are going to refuge. All of us have places, activities, physical, geographical, interpersonal, that we go to get away from our suffering and to feel happy to feel restored. Is that clear? We also have an inner world. Many of us, and this is, you know, many of us, we take refuge in, you know, in our reputation, right? And who we think we are. We take refuge in our self-righteousness, our sense of rightness in all our views. These days, people take refuge in their political views, don't they? That's where they go to feel good. We take refuge in mind states. Many of us, we go to our anger, don't we? We go to our critical, judgmental mind to feel, I'm right, they're wrong, I'm on the right path. I mean, many of us could go to the opposite way. Many of us go to our unworthiness, our helplessness. Right? That's where we go for refuge in the storm of life. So again, just take a moment to ask yourself, just let's reflect for a moment and ask ourselves, in truth, not ideally, but if I look at my life, where do I go for refuge? That momentarily I feel good. Momentarily my suffering ends and I feel okay. Even happy. And again, they're not like these are bad. I mean, it's just really acknowledging, yeah, I already have unconsciously a very sophisticated way that I deal with my desire to feel safe, secure, not to suffer. Just kind of look at your life, your past, just for a moment. Truly, where do I take refuge? Even though outwardly I may say this and that. I may take refuge in my thoughts, my intellect. Many of us, when we listen to our thoughts, we think we're brilliant. And we're amazed that nobody else sees it that way. Where do we go for refuge? And most importantly, over time, do they work? Have they delivered to me what I sought? Have they made me really happy? Have they made me really feel safe? Or is it something that I have to continually go back to, go back to? In other words, I am dependent. I am dependent on these things. So in the same way, before we really go about significant change in our life, we have to reach a point where we see and understand quite deeply that the way we've been living our life is not working for me, right? I mean, everybody I'm sure here knows exactly that's why we're here, right? At some degree or another, our life is not working for us. But many of us don't know why it isn't. So one of the things I'm just, you know, posing today is maybe it's because we unconsciously have a very elaborate sense of refuge in all kinds of situations that I've, you know, we've all enumerated, And yet, they don't, when you add them all up, they don't seem to work in any deep and consistent way over time. They either don't produce the desired result, or I just have to, you know, I have to keep going back to the beach. Take in another sundown. Again, in our society, it's a lot around stress. You know, what do I have to always be doing to de-stress myself? So I can face another Monday, you know. Are there any questions about this before I start talking about a true refuge? Yes. Yeah, we just have a live stream. They can't hear the questions.
In the comment of self-liberate, even the antidote, if we find that we're going to refuge in meditation or in Lojong, when do we know when we're ready to self-liberate even that?
Well, I appreciate your question, but that's a little off topic for today. But I'm very happy to discuss that with you at another time. Yeah, that's good. Because we have limited time today, and I really want to talk about more classical refuge. Any other questions just about what I talked about so far in terms of looking at our own lives? Good. So in Buddhism and in this transmission ceremony in I think the first week of February, I will be transmitting to anybody who is seeking transmission, the transmission of what's called in Buddhism the three refuges, three jewels, which are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So I want to talk to you about them. And we can understand refuge both as the sort of external and internal, outer and inner. That's sort of, Buddhism has a lot of that outer and inner stuff. So we might say the outer refuge is, we might say, Shakyamuni Buddha. Okay. Why do we take refuge in the Buddha? Okay. Because he was a human being who was just like us, who dealt with the same sort of situations in life just like us, who began to ask questions about life and meaning of life and purpose of life and happiness and suffering and permanence and all these kind of impermanence and all these things, and devoted himself single-mindedly to answering these questions. And just like us, he wandered about. And he took teaching from this one, and he took teaching from that one, and he practiced this meditative system and this spiritual system, and just like us. So he's a model to us of somebody who looks deeply into life beyond the momentariness of life. And then the interesting thing about the Buddha as sort of a model for us, somebody that we can relate to, is at the end of his 6 years of seeking, he eventually got to the point where he just turned within and looked to his own mind, his own wisdom, for the answers he sought. And according to Buddhist belief, he had a great enlightenment. He was enlightened into the true nature of thing, and all the positive qualities of his mind, of his wisdom, of his intelligence, fully manifested in that time. He was an awakened being. Meaning what? He just had awakened to the truth of who and what he really was. So why is this important? Why do we go to refuge in the Buddha? Because if we are, if we see the unsatisfactory of the way we've been doing it up to now and the way so many other people in the world do it, we need some kind of example of the right way to do it and the possibility of doing that as a human being. So to take refuge in the Buddha is to take refuge in both the example, you know, the living example of the Buddha, but most importantly, that understanding that ultimately we have to turn and find the Buddha within ourselves. We begin with the outer Buddha that we take refuge, but it's to help us purify ourselves through practice, through meditation, everything, that we begin to experience the Buddha within ourselves, which is not like a little person in the full lotus posture. Is that clear? So those of you who've been practicing the Buddha within by looking for or visualizing, you know, if you've been frustrated, it doesn't look like that. Buddha is a Buddha because he has cultivated, she has cultivated the innate wisdom and capacity of their own mind. Because they understand the nature of mind, the nature of reality, and sort of the laws of how this world operates, so they can operate with intelligence. Right? And so refuge in the Buddha begins as an external refuge when we need. It's like when we're little, we need parents, don't we? Do you remember that? We needed parents. We were children. We weren't able to really make wise decisions for ourselves. Is that true? Right? But hopefully, over time, we were less dependent on our parents because we were able to internalize a certain level of understanding and intelligence of causes and conditions and effect, and you know that we could navigate this world because we had our own internal compass, we had our own internal values. Is that clear? We can you see that process? So that dependency on our parents and maybe our relationship with our parents changed as we became less dependent. And so the same way we transition from seeing the Buddha as an external refuge to seeing the Buddha as an internal refuge, and more we hear the voice of our own innate wisdom. Now, let me also add, especially in the meditative tradition, the role of teachers. You know, and we are fortunate in this world system that there are still great teachers who appear in this world. Because if we didn't have living teachers, we would just have a what? A story. Right? You know, many religions exist with stories about their founder. But we don't see a lot of evidence that the representatives of those systems today have the same depth and enlightenment of the founder, do we? We are fortunate. Because in Buddhism, it is a living transition of an experience and a practice that we have living examples today, right? And that makes it real for us, right? Oh, it's not just historically, but right now, there are human beings, look like me, act like me, have to eat, get sick, you know, just like me, who yet I can see in the way they conduct themselves that they have reached a certain degree of understanding and wisdom, which is illustrative of this capability of enlightenment, awakening, freedom from suffering of all of us. Okay, so it's very important that not only that we have the historical Buddha, but we have the living Buddhas, not Buddhas exactly, living exemplars of the Buddha nature that inspire us, right? All of us know that, right? If we've been through an education system, if we've been through sports or career, when we have come across a real mentor, right? And just take a moment to think. Have you in your life come across real mentors? People who exemplified, who were enthusiastic, who inspired you with your capability of developing yourself in a career, in a skill, in an education, in academic craft. Is everybody clear? We know how important that is. You know, it's more than just having the book. So the living presence of teachers is very important. And that we can recognize that. Right? And I'm sure if everybody here has been through the educational system, if I said, can you remember your good teachers? And can you remember your not so good teachers? And can you remember your really poor teachers? Right? Can you say you can discriminate? Can't you? You can understand that. Right? And you can think of your life and think about people who are really there for you in a good way and had a certain degree of wisdom, you know what I mean? And those who weren't. Do you see how important that is? And that we know the difference. We need to know who to take refuge in this life. Many of us might have many people in our lives of all types who give us advice. But does everybody, or do all these people always give us wise advice? Helpful advice? Are they really dispassionate and really only want our best, or do they have their own agendas? You know, think about it. So, you know, we need to recognize real gold from fool's gold. And that's why refuge is so important. Okay? So that's refuge in the Buddha, internal and external. The next refuge is refuge in the Dharma. Dharma has multiple meanings, but we might say, you know, at least outwardly, it is that body of teaching and practice that the Buddha and the enlightened masters have taught and continue to teach, right? So, you know, I need a teaching. I need teachings that explain to me what this life is about, what's going on here, how to lead a meaningful life, how to deal with affliction, how to deal with my own mind, how to deal with my mother-in-law, you know. I need all kinds of teachings. Right? To guide me. I need practices. Right? Oh, yeah, I want to calm and stabilize my mind. I need practices. I want to become more loving, more kind, more compassionate. I need practices. I want to develop patience. I need practices. Right? So this body of wisdom, philosophical, psychological, practical, meditative, analytical meditations, all this is the Dharma. Okay? And it is very important if we want to move our life in a different direction than it is, that we have the support of a coherent body of teaching and practice so we can what? So we can relax. So we can relax. You know, and know, the Dharma is also called the path. Right? It's like, you're no longer lost in the woods, or you no longer have to hack your own path through the woods, or you no longer have to follow all these paths with all these signs, and they all tell you they're going to some good place, and then you go for a while, and you find out they really don't go where they say they go. Right? We all know. We've all been there. Wouldn't it be wonderful that we can find a path that has a goal, and it's the goal where I want to get to, and the path is well trodden, it's been trodden for 2,600 years, I can trust it, I can have confidence in it, and I can relax and just follow the path. Right? In the beginning, when we're seekers, we have somewhat of a critical mind, right? It's good. We evaluate, we compare, you know, does this make sense? Does it meet with my intellect? Or, you know, do the people really follow through on what they say, right? But wouldn't it be wonderful to get to a point where I go, yeah, this is a good path. It's a true path. I've met many people on it who are walking. Yeah, they all. I've met people who've walked it. No, I can trust this path. Now, in the beginning, just like in other areas of our life, the Dharma is something external. It's like, you know, what am I supposed to be practicing? Or, you know, what's the teaching for that? You know, we're always, it's something external to ourselves. But at least we have something that we can bring into our lives to guide us. But again, over time, and many of you, again, in your professional, other, you know, music, other things, you know, over time, it becomes more part of you, right? You develop some mastery, some competence, right? You're not always kind of a novice. And the same way, over time, if we've been really studying and practicing effectively, we begin to, through the practice of the Dharma, through the study and practice of the Dharma, and the understanding and what it brings us, we now have beginning to awaken the truth of our own being, the truth of these teachings. And, you know, the great truth of the Buddha was when he became enlightened, he became enlightened to his own nature. Betsy invited us to bow to the Buddha. Why do we bow to the Buddha? As a representative of the awakened quality nature of each of us. We already have it. But it is covered by kleshas. In Buddhism, we call them kleshas. Kleshas are what? They're operations, they're coverings. But it's already here. So the Dharma is the methodology of study and practice that allows us to purify and clarify the obscurations so we can see the truth of our own mind, of our own wisdom, of our own compassion, of our own natural intelligence, right? Why can't we see that now? People might say, gee, if that's my real nature, why can't I see it? It's obscured. What's it obscured by? Our afflictive emotions, our wrong thinking, our egocentricity, our, you know, our this endless bifurcating mind that's all over the place and is always running after what? Momentary pleasure. Right? You know, our minds are very busy, aren't they? Very active, running here, running there. And so, you know, who has time to really look and really see what is really causing me to be less than happy, to not have a peaceful mind, a harmonious mind, a mind at ease, a heart that's loving and kind and open. Why not? It's a good question to ask ourselves. So the Dharma, to take refuge in the Dharma means I've kind of, at least for now, I can commit myself to this path. And finally, the third refuge is Sangha. Sangha, you know, it sort of means community, the community of persons who practice the Buddha's way. Now, traditionally in the Buddha Sangha, it's called the Fourfold Sangha, because of the kind of commitments that these different types make. Traditionally in Buddhism, and you see it more when you go to Asia, but you see it's also somewhat in American Buddhism, is there are monks and nuns who basically in Buddhism live a celibate life and have lots of vows, and it's a very structured kind of life. And then you have lay people like us, men and women. So that's the Fourfold Sangha. But also traditionally in Mahayana Buddhism, which is the broader tradition we practice, we talk about the ordinary Sangha and the Arya Sangha. Okay? So we are the ordinary Sangha, right? We are the ordinary beings who are doing our best to follow this way. The extraordinary Sangha, or in Sanskrit, the Arya, the greater Sangha, is the Sangha of human beings who had awakening. Not necessarily full awakening, they're not all Buddhas, but these are the masters, these are the great teachers. Right? Because, and again, I want to talk about the ordinary Sangha because this is our, you know, this is our Sangha. But, you know, the blind can have a Sangha of blind people. Right? But if there's nobody who sees, the fundamental problem of being blind is still weighs heavily. Right? So we can get a lot of comfort, we can get a lot of inspiration and support from our ordinary Sangha, but we don't necessarily know how to resolve the issues of our own suffering. We don't necessarily know how to practice the Buddha way effectively. And we don't know how to wake ourselves up. So we rely on the Arya Sangha. So these are the two communities to take refuge in. So we acknowledge, you know, the great masters who are still alive in the world and the ones historically, you know, those are the ones we take sort of a higher refuge in. But this, you know, what we have in our community and what you may have in your own communities is very important. One, for it's good to have spiritual friends. Right, many of us have friends who support us in many ways, but in this very key thing of our own healing and transformation and awakening and the path we're following, many of our friends are not interested, or they don't have a clue, right? Or they're following their own paths. So it's good to have spiritual friends, people who understand what you're up to, you know, kind of get it, and are very supportive and are kind of working the path alongside you. Is that clear? It's good to have those kinds of people in their life. Doesn't mean, you know, you can't have other friends or family and good friends, and yeah, that's all good. But it means to have a sangha, a community, is very helpful to the path. As you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, traditionally, Buddha Dharma Sangha would sort of be oftentimes, in other words, the two big ones were Buddha and Dharma, right? The traditional, you know. And Sangha was, you know, nice if you could have it, but not really all that essential. But Thich Nhat Hanh has elevated Sangha in this age for several reasons. One is, again, because the thickness, the coarseness of the materialism of our age, the consumerism of our age, the kind of values, and now we're into fake news, so we don't even know what's true anymore when we receive information. It is very difficult to practice by ourselves. And there are many people who come and join our community, and when I get to know them, they tell me, oh, well, I've been practicing on my own. Many people, they say, I've been practicing meditation on my own, or I've been reading Buddhist books or listening to Buddhist podcasts for years on my own. And it hasn't really worked. I need community. I need spiritual friends. So this is, this is a very key piece. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh says, again, it's almost impossible for an individual these days on their own to really develop themselves without the support of some type of community, spiritual friends. And many of you may know that. The other thing about when you have a real community, which means, you know, there are a lot of little spiritual groups that aren't a community. So people may come, they may do meditation or other kinds of practices together, and then they leave, right? So they really, the interaction is very minimal, right? So so like in this community, when we started here in Tampa, you know, we had a good community, and people, we met in a yoga studio, and we rented a yoga studio, and we met there once a week in the evenings. And then we also did sort of retreats. I mean, we did practice things, but there wasn't that much interaction with each other, and especially around, you know, anyhow, I'll get into that. And then, maybe, 8 years ago when we, so when we made the decision to get, you know, have our own place, you know, basically I told people, now things will get interesting. Right? Because you get a bunch of human beings together, and when there are choices and decisions to make, what do they tend to do? What? Squabble. And again, even if they're nice people and they don't verbalize it, in their mind they squabble. But also people rub up against again. They get friction, they get conflicts, you know. People get in our way, or people aren't doing it the way we want or how we think they should, right? So this is good. You know, my response when anybody comes to me and goes, I'm having a little trouble with this person, I say, great, wonderful. Okay. More opportunity to practice. So, yeah, and the wonderful thing is about a sangha, and I think the wonderful thing about this community, or having, you know, and you may have your own community, I don't know, is your squabbling or your friction with other practitioners. Okay? This is important. You know, so you're rubbing against other people, and the other people are rubbing up against you, but hopefully both of you have a commitment to look at yourselves, right? And not blame and not judge, and to, you know, use it as an opportunity to free yourself of our own egocentricity, our own, you know, pettiness, and, you know, our need to control and manipulate, okay? So, in a sense, Sangha is an ideal place to transform. Because again, we are interacting with people who kind of are on the same path. Right? So we, you know, and in our community, we have beginning anew, we have other kinds of ways, we have mindful communication and conflict resolution, which allows us, when there is conflict between people, to resolve it in a healthy way. The unhealthy way would be to kind of blast each other, or we don't encourage gossip, we don't encourage third party, you know, if you've got a problem with somebody, you go talk to them. I mean, people come to me, have you talked to them? You know, don't tell me. You don't have a problem with me. You know, if you have a problem with them, you know, you to learn how to talk to them. Right? It's a skill. Mindful communication. Right? So in that sense, Sangha is very important. But again, you know, over time, you know, we don't want the refuge in Sangha to be exclusive. I mean, it's like a family. We all have special relations with our family, special love for our family, special commitment to our family. But ideally, we want to learn how to be friendly with everyone, to offer friendship and kindness and compassion with everyone. So hopefully, this is more like an incubation place or a laboratory where we're learning, but hopefully we take it out, right? I mean, if we're just kind of kind and nice and friendly with each other, and that we're the same rotten person with the rest of the world, or we're the same, arrogant or self-righteous or angry, or, you know, why aren't people, you know, why isn't everybody a Buddhist? That's what I want to know. You know, that's wrong thinking. We need to learn to accept people as they are, accept the world the way it is, love them the way they are, understand them the way they are, and work with them to help them. So again, it's a should be a turning out. So let me stop. I just want to talk a little bit about refuge. So basically what goes on here, we have a refuge ceremony. I think it's in February. For those it'll be a public ceremony. We'll be transmitting the refuges and the trainings to people who want to take them and have gone through a class, a preparatory class, as well as, and this is, many of you have been around, we have an order of intervene in our community, which is sort of the core of our community. I think we have over 50 people plus who are in that community, either as ordained or aspirants. And every year we open it up for new aspirants who want to begin the mentoring program. And we will be acknowledging them at the ceremony too. Anything I've missed?
We do have an announcement about the class.
Okay, so we'll get to that in a minute. But any questions more generically? And there are people here who, who are new, or Buddhist, non-Buddhist, it really doesn't matter. But just, I want to give a general sense. I mean, and there may be meaningful things that people hear or take refuge in. So any questions?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, it's got to be, thank you, Richard.
Thank you so much for your talk. It's wonderful to be here. I want to ask you a question about taking refuge in the Buddha and in the wise teachers that are on the planet. I think we both know a number of very wise and esteemed teachers who turned out to be other than what people thought they were taking refuge in.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I know what Richard's referring to, and it's not just a problem in Buddhism. It can be a little problem in Buddhism, especially in certain traditions which the teacher is really elevated to almost like, the living Buddha. So it's a little more dangerous in a certain sense for people who use that. But again, to the hypocrisy of spiritual, religious, cult leaders, to not be who they say they are, is known to all of us, right? In all religious traditions. It is interesting. And I haven't been able to find it again, but I did find a teaching from the Buddha. I mean, first of all, there are teachings. Let me get that straight. There are teachings in the Buddhist tradition, just like with refuge, would tell you how to judge a teacher, all the qualities of a teacher. Okay? So it's not blind. Now, the problem is acting. Right? If you're a good professional actor, you could certainly act as a guru. Right? So there's the problem. The interesting thing in this teaching, and it's like I can't, I haven't been able to find it. One of the things I haven't been able to find it again. Basically, what the Buddha said was, first thing is live with your teacher. Okay? It's very interesting, And we know, if you go back to Shakyamuni Buddha historically, he lived very openly. He lived out in the open. He lived with his followers, right, 24/7. Who he was and how he was very public. You see, so people could really see there was a consistency. There wasn't a public Buddha and a private Buddha. In the background, he's screaming and yelling at everybody, telling them to count the Dana, right. So, okay, so this is interesting. So the first thing is live with the teacher. Then you can really observe them closely. The second, if you can't live with a teacher, try to spend some time with them. Right? Okay. Try to spend some time with them. So at least you have some, observation of them outside of their formal role. All right. If you can't do that, then talk to somebody who is living with them. And ask them, what is this person really like behind the scenes? You see what I'm saying? And then it kind of goes like that. It goes, I forget, there were five steps. And the fifth one is sort of like, just do your best, you know, to make up your mind. And again, you know, so I think that's the problem, you know, and it is a problem, especially these days, where there's often a lack of intimacy between students and teachers. You know, many people are encountering teachers in big retreats where, you know, they're one of hundreds, or, you know, we know in Tignan, thousands, or, you know, you listen to them on podcasts or this or that. So it's harder these days that we don't have that, you know, that intimacy. But again, I don't think it's that difficult. You know, I think ultimately, you know, I was just telling that story to somebody who's on solitary retreat. I remember, now the Tibetan tradition really elevates the teacher almost, which is, if you spend time in their tradition, you understand how it works and why they do it. But I remember Dzogchen Rinpoche said to me, as he was giving me the kind of traditional teaching on the teacher, and he said, you know, so if your teacher even asked you to jump off a cliff, you would jump off a cliff. And then he goes, but I would never ask you to jump off a cliff. You know? I mean, which basically saying you have to trust your teacher, that they really want your best. But if they ask you to jump off a cliff, a red flag should go up, you know. And I think it is very, you know, I remember somebody once said, you know, when you're dating somebody, you keep both eyes open. But when you marry them, you close one eye. and I think that's also in truth, you know, with our spiritual teachers. You know, in the beginning, when we are searching, I think it's good to keep both eyes open. You know, so we, and if you see things that are seem incongruent, that you use your good mind. When I say critical thinking, I don't mean like critical, like judgmental, but the critical thinking mean your capacity to think logically and to, you know, should be there. You know, but, you know, you do close one eye, but you do keep one eye open in your relationship to your teacher and your sangha. That, you know, that you do expect your teacher to live according to the principles they're talking about. I mean, basically what we're talking about in all these situations, it's not just the hypocrisy of presenting themselves, and then it is the hypocrisy that they present themselves or they teach one way, and yet behind the scenes act in a totally different way. Right? I mean, if they were up there in their teaching, you know, sexual misconduct and embezzlement and yourself, you know what I mean? They'd go, well, at least they're coherent. Right? <Yeah. laughs> You know, I mean, right. You've been warned off. But I think, yeah. So I think that's important. So that's why, you know, traditionally in Buddhism, in terms of what we're talking about here in terms of the teacher, but also in terms of refuge, you know, it goes back to the Buddha. You know, the Buddha said to his own disciples, he said, do not take anything I say because you love me, because I'm the Buddha, because you deeply respect me. He said, you can use that as the approach, but then you have to take it in and contemplate it, reflect on it through your own intellect, through your own logic, and then you practice it and you see whether it works. I mean, it's very interesting, you know, not too many religions kind of invite you to use your critical faculties and your direct experience to test it out. Is that clear? So again, you know, oftentimes when I meet people and they're interested in our community, I say, well, you know, come a while, check it out, you know, meet the people, make sure that, you know, it really is what it appears to be. You know, you don't have to jump right into it, right? Because when we make a choice, you know, we want to make a choice that we can commit to, right? Sort of like dating, right? I mean, in the beginning you can date, but if you're going to make a commitment, then you want to have some dating experience, right? Something to make a choice from. So I think that's the same thing with choosing a teacher or sangha, you know. But on the other hand, I think it's important that, sort of like people have commitment issues these days, people have commitment issues. Like at a certain point, it may be time to commit, you see? I mean, it's good to seek, but you're seeking because you want to find something. So always to be a seeker and never a finder, I think, is not very meaningful, not very satisfying. I think it's good to seek, right? Compare, but I think at a certain point, you know, just like in other areas of our life, you know, we want to settle down and make a commitment so we can benefit from the practice and the tradition. Is that clear? And then we can relax. Then we can relax. You know, once you're in a committed relationship of any kind, you know, yeah, I mean, whatever happens, I'm present to it, you know, I'll work through it, but, you know, I'm not still seeking, right? People who enter so-called committed relationships, but in their mind, they're still seeking. Is that relationship going to work? Right. So this is important for any relationship, and especially, you know, in a spiritual relationship, because this gets to the essence, you know, relationships, work, you know, they're all temporary and they're all externally based. You know, if we restore ourselves in nature, then we are not free, because if we don't have nature accessible to us, we suffer. You know, whatever it is that we take worldly refuge, work, money, pleasure, whatever it is dependent on something external to us. There's no freedom in that. And this whole practice is learning how to be free. We want to be free. And so we want to be able to internalize our refuge, right? When you've internalized your refuge, it doesn't matter what's going on outside you. You have the capacity of cultivating your own inner peace, your inner harmony, you know, in your own mind, in your own actions. And that's freedom. The worldly refuges that we looked at in the beginning, they may work in the short term, but there's no freedom because there's dependency, isn't there? Now, even with the refuges in the beginning, as we said, when it's more external, we are somewhat dependent. But the process is moving away from dependency. Just the same way when we're children, you know, we need a parent, a little stronger presence in our life, but hopefully over time, as we become more self-empowered, you know, we are less reliant. Right? And for those of us who have raised children, who have become adults, we like that, don't we? When they become less dependent, more able to function on their own and make their own decisions and choices. That feels good. And a good teacher in a spiritual teaching wants to see their students empowered. Understands in the beginning there's greater dependency and greater need because people, you know, just don't know the way. But over time, they will develop their own inner Buddha Dharma Sangha and their own abilities and competencies and be less dependent. So with that, we'll end for today. Thank you very much.